All right, so as I said, the topic today is on the rise of esports. We have a set of questions we're going to ask our panelists. Again, for all attendees, we'll be accepting questions from you guys throughout the discussion, and we'll leave time at the end for the panelists to address these questions. Before I introduce the panelists, I'd like to introduce myself and my behind-the-scenes co-host. My name is Michael Vanasky. I'm a senior analyst with the Innovation Group in our Denver office. And my co-host, who you will not be seeing, is Chris Irwin. He's helping me out behind the scenes here, and he's also a senior analyst out of our Denver office. So the purpose of this webinar is to provide a high-level overview of the esports industry for outsiders, including the top games played, growth of the industry, and current trending topics surrounding esports. Additionally, we'll highlight the opportunities the nascent industry is providing to the gaming industry from both an operational and a betting perspective. Just some high-level information on esports. Estimates indicate that the industry generated total revenue of $325 million in 2015, and that represents year-over-year growth of over 67%. Experts also estimate this figure will surpass $1 billion by 2019. On top of this, the betting industry related to esports is estimated at $2 billion as of 2015, and that's estimated to exceed $23 billion by 2020. So for these reasons, among many others, esports continues to receive a lot of media attention, but it's still relatively unknown to industry outsiders. And that is why we have our panel of experts here to shed some light on the industry and offer their insights on the history of esports and where they see it going in the future. With that, I'll introduce our panelists and have them tell us a little bit about themselves and their experience as it relates to esports. So our first panelist is Dr. Brett Barbanel. Brett is the head of social and recreational gambling research at UCLA. So Brett, could you just say a few things about yourself and your experience within esports?
Sure. My name is Brett Abarbanel. As Mike mentioned, I'm over at the UCLA Gambling Studies Program, and I've been working on research within esports and gambling for the past about 2 years now, and prior to that, my research experience is primarily in online gambling and other applications.
Great. Well, welcome, and thanks for joining us. Our next panelist is Seth Shore. Seth is the chairman of the Downtown Grand in Las Vegas. Seth, if you don't mind.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. My name is Seth Shore. I'm the chairman of the Downtown Grand Las Vegas and CEO of Fifth Street Gaming. We began looking at esports about 2 years ago as well. We've been activating various esports events, tournaments, and activities in our property since last early fall, I guess the last September, coming on a year, and looking forward to discussing those in greater detail throughout the fall.
Welcome, Seth. And our last panelist is Hai Un. Hai is a partner at Neomancer. Hai, if you want to say a few words.
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm a founding partner at Neomancer. We're a technology, strategy, and management consultancy. I've been a gamer for, I guess, going on about 4 decades now. Never played professionally, but have worked in the esports realm in and out from the developer side all the way to the organizational side for probably the last decade or so in the background. So really excited now that esports is starting to gain legs and getting into the other industries.
Thanks for that, Hai. And again, we appreciate all of our panelists and attendees for joining. And we see the comments on the noise and the background noise, and we're working on that now. So again, hopefully that clears up. And if you're still experiencing any difficulties, please just let us know. So with that, we will go into the questions. And again, just as a reminder to attendees, please remember to submit your questions directly to me, the host, and we'll leave time at the end to address those questions. All right, so the first question for our panelists is just a high-level one. How do you describe esports and its history to industry outsiders? And then as a follow-up, what have been the most important milestones for the industry to date? Brett, do you want to take that?
I was actually going to suggest
Hi
start with this one.
Okay.
Hi,
if you want to.
Well, in the simplest terms, esports is essentially competitive video gaming. And you could literally say that that has started, you know, the history of that can go all the way back. And, you know, most articles do credit a particular space war game that happened at Stanford many, many years ago. As the first organized tournament of a video game that happened in one single place. But since then, I mean, really, everybody who games knows that, you know, it's part of the competition that really drives gaming. And about 10 or so, a little over 10 years ago, one of the organizations started happening, and we had World Cyber Games and whatnot in Asia. And the first kind of pop-up of it was essentially in Korea when, you know, there was the economic downturn and they started building a lot of infrastructure, you know, extremely good broadband and a lot of internet cafes came up. And people started playing games very competitively and they had competitions and contests and that spawned World Cyber Games. And I would say probably, you know, one of the most significant, I would say kind of like a boost for the industry really happened with Twitch. You know, that's kind of why I feel it brought it to the mainstream. It brought it to everybody. You can now watch people play games 24 hours a day. And then came the prizes because of the people trying to reach the audiences. And with today, you know, TI6, which is the Dota Championship Defense of the Ancients, which is a multiplayer online battle arena game that is played competitively, has this year's prize is $18 million. So that draws a lot of attention.
I'll also add that the history of esports is not a direct parallel to gambling, but there are also periods of both progress and regress that we see much in the same way that we've seen with gambling. So, for example, in Nevada, gambling has been legalized multiple times, because it's also been banned multiple times. And, of course, now we have plenty of gambling in the state. But these bans tended to follow periods of, for example, scandal. So, and not to necessarily say that esports is wrought with scandal, but we've seen, again, these periods of progress and regress that follow from scandalous events. So, for example, there was some major StarCraft. So StarCraft, again, we're naming lots of games here. StarCraft, a major game from Blizzard, a one-on-one strategy game. And in 2009-2010, there was a major scandal in Korea surrounding StarCraft. And as a result, there was increased scrutiny on the industry, increased expectations from industry groups, and many of the people who were caught cheating and causing this cheating scandal are being tried in criminal court in Korea. And because of that, even though it was a fairly negative event, a lot of positive progress happened from it.
Great, great. Thanks for that, guys. And I think you touched a little bit on the next question. I guess just with the rapid growth in the industry, Hi, you mentioned this, that the number of competitive events and prize pools have been doubling every year since 2012. So I guess, can you guys just talk a little bit more about how esports evolved over the past several years?
Brett, you want to take that first?
Sure. Well, I mean, what I did for this question really is I listed a couple of what I thought were sort of major events since 2012 that have really moved forward. And the first one that I came up with is when Heroes of the Storm aired on ESPN2 in April of 2015. This was really the first time that a major esports event had appeared on, but really was mainstream television that was is dedicated to sports broadcasting, but really recognized this video game as equivalent in many ways to sports, and that really brought a lot of attention to the industry. Earlier this year, when ESPN put esports news on their homepage, that was a major event as well. And it really, again, it has helped bring esports much more into the public eye. And we start to see things like this webinar or an $18 million prize pool for the international for Dota 2, and a number of other events as well that have involved both esports and then also esports betting, which I know we'll get to in a.
Yeah, the prize pools are definitely a big attractor. Obviously, if you put up a big prize, and one good demonstration of that happened is earlier this year, or late last year, Microsoft put up a prize of about $2 million for Halo 5. Halo, you know, some of you might be familiar with this franchise. It was one of the launch franchises for the Xbox that took the Xbox into kind of the spotlight. And when, you know, Bungie left, after Halo 4, a lot of critics were saying, well, you know, Halo is going to start suffering because, you know, a lot of fans are going to leave and defect over to Destiny, which is Bungie's latest game or current game. And that indeed happened with some of the sales statistics that you saw. And what Microsoft did with Halo 5, they created an arena that was balanced and could be competitive. And what they did was they put $2 million up as a prize for everybody to grab, and sales rocketed. It went up. It became relevant again as a game. So as a tool, esports competitions as a marketing tool worked very well and has continued working. And perhaps another great example is Counter-Strike, or more commonly now known as CSGO, which stands for Counter-Strike Global Operations. The current incarnation of this game. And if any of you have played games in the past, this game has been around for a very, very long time. And in fact, when it started, it wasn't even a game. It was a hack. It was a modification of an existing game called Half-Life, and which was supposed to be, you would shoot aliens, but then it was converted to be a terrorist, counter-terrorist game. And that really caught on in the competitive world, and it has been played competitively for, it's probably one of the longest played competitive games ever. So, you know, competitive gaming really does, you know, do a lot for the industry itself, so you can see why people do it.
Definitely, thanks for that. And so moving on. And I know you guys have both touched on this again. You're getting ahead of me here with the questions, but just can you talk a little bit more about how social media and streaming platforms such as Twitch have contributed to the growth of the industry?
Well, as Brett mentioned earlier, until very recently, you couldn't see gaming on TV. But that has changed very rapidly in the last year, I would say 6 months, with ESPN signing on, Sky TV in the UK has been doing it for a while, TNT, Turner, big time has come in, not only from the broadcast level, but also from the tournament organizational level, just 2 days ago, I believe, or maybe even yesterday, announcing a $300,000 prize for Overwatch, competition. So, but before that, it was basically Twitch, and before that, it was basically bulletin boards and, you know, all the other mechanisms that gamers would communicate with one another, through the various channels. And it's huge. What it does is it connects the community together, and that's what builds the community. Brett, you're smiling, so.
Twitch especially was this huge revolutionary change for the industry. It puts the game itself front and center. And one of the things that it does that we don't even get from TV is it permits interactivity with the professional gamer, with the streamer. The example I always like to give is a somewhat old example at this point, but very famous streamer named Day9 used to host events through his stream. And he would do things called it, for example, Funday Monday. So every Monday he would put out a challenge, and people would send in video of their own gameplay, and then he would incorporate it into his stream, and there's chat availability, so you could communicate with your streamers as well. And it's not just esports, it's also some of that crossover between gambling and esports with poker. Poker is one of the primary featured channels on Twitch. Usually, and I think this is very intelligent, the streamers have a time delay on their stream of about 5 minutes. So if I'm playing against someone, I can't just pull up the same table and take all their money because I know their whole cards. But this also is something that Twitch has allowed, and it's more than just, for example, an observation mode that you might have in a video game, and that it really allows communication in a way that you don't have necessarily with other sports stars or, celebrities. Many of these guys are celebrities. And then finally, one of the things that Twitch has really allowed is it's really opened the door for sponsorship and advertising. For example, just a chair that you'll sit in. If I am a streamer and I have to get up and go to the bathroom, what do you think is appearing on the screen? It's just my chair. You can have that. The chair itself is a product that's being advertised, as well as advertisement or branding that might appear on the chair. We have user interface, the setup that one might have on their screen can have advertisements. We've seen gambling companies already advertising, and I don't just mean the skin setting, advertising on some of these streams. For example, PokerStars had a partnership, or has still, I believe, a partnership with a number of Hearthstone streamers. So all of these things are possible because these streaming platforms exist.
And the one thing I would add is like every other successful platform that has happened in the last 5 years, it democratizes the users as well. Anybody can stream on Twitch. I mean, you could create an account right now and go fire up your if you want to do solitaire, you could stream that, and if you get lucky and you go viral and now all of a sudden everybody's tuning into you. There is also monetization that's built into Twitch where if I'm watching somebody play a game or somebody's watching me play a game and I, kind of show them a move that I've always been doing, which I thought was cool, but they think, wow, this is incredible. They can actually tip me. They can give me money, real money, that is. And people have actually made a living, doing this where they would play games. As a gamer, I would say the ultimate nirvana is to be paid to play a game. And a lot of these people on Twitch, there are a lot of people on Twitch that make a living basically just playing a game. It could be as simple as, like, for example, one game that I mentioned earlier that was done by Bungie that's non-competitive. It's called Destiny. And it's a shared world. It's sort of like a massively multiplayer online game, but it's a first-person shooter. It has a lot of weapons. And there's a whole host of people who Twitch basically demonstrating weapons and how good these weapons are. And people will pay them because it's like, having a Wikipedia of weapons in real demonstration. So it's part of the attraction for this is that nobody on Twitch is really passive. You can be active if you want to. You can speak with your wallet. You can speak with your mic. You can speak with your gaming skills.
From an operator's perspective, one of the things that we've noticed is our ability to communicate with the community to drive traffic to our weekly eSport contests or our larger events is directly contingent upon who we're speaking with in the community and who we've partnered with to leverage their social reach. And while certainly, that's a tactic that's used when speaking to any millennial, we found that in eSports, traditional advertising has, quite frankly, no value whatsoever. Communicating with this audience is entirely done on social, which, quite frankly, from an operator's perspective, is great. It's much easier to evaluate our success. It's quite frankly, a lot cheaper than traditional advertising. But like I said, it's we've seen the value in who we've been able to partner with. So if we have a weekly contest, and we have a professional player from the game or genre of that contest, and he or she is retweeting our tweet or reposting our Facebook posts, we find much greater attendance at that particular contest.
Great, great. No, and I think it makes sense that it's just been the social media platforms have sort of accelerated the growth of the industry and really just help it continue to spread. Just moving on to the betting aspect of the industry, just how has esports betting evolved? And I know you guys touched on this a little bit, but what areas of esports betting are the most concerning right now?
The most concerning, as in good for business or bad for business? Because if it's bad for business, it's probably the skin betting problem right now that's out there. And that's getting shut down pretty fast. For those of you who are not aware of esports betting, there Legal Sports Report just published a nice little primer today, which I just tweeted out about an hour ago. That actually lists all the different ways that you could now play real money, cash money with esports. Everything from betting on single outcome tournaments to fantasy to skin betting. And, you know, skin betting, basically, it's not white slavery, as the term kind of makes people think, but it's, basically in some games like Counter-Strike, you can, get skins, which are decorative overlays that you could put on your character, on your weapons or different weapons to make them look different from everybody else's weapons. And what Valve has done over the years is they've released an API that allows people, players, to actually trade these skins between one another and actually sell them for Steam credits on Steam's system. So you can never get them out as cash, technically, but they have value. Now, what has happened, obviously, with the ingenuity of the internet is somebody actually now, many people have sites where they will buy these skins from you, and some of these skins can cost quite a lot. And again, remember, these skins have no operative value in-game. It doesn't make your character more powerful. It doesn't make your bullets do better. It's just purely decorative. It's putting on a shirt or, you know, putting on a cap. And some of these items can sell for upwards of $2,000 to $5,000 a piece. And this, again, is virtual. There is no real substance. So the really controversial system now is betting with these skins. There are sites that are rapidly being shut down at this point because of a change in TOS, or clarification, I should say, of the TOS from Terms of Service from Valve, is that you could essentially bet on games like roulette, tossing a coin, blackjack, or betting on an actual esports tournament with these virtual goods, these virtual skins. And that has created a lot of controversy because there is no age verification. It's not regulated. And there have been a lot of accusations of actually weighted RNGs where celebrities were told if they were going to win, so they would bet a really expensive piece of skin just to bring in a lot of other counter bets. And essentially, they already knew that who was going to win. And that created a lot of controversy. And like Brett has said earlier, this is probably one of those times that for the immediate thing, kind of looks bad for esports, but in the end, in the long run, it's probably going to be better because regulations are going to be in place and, you know, things like this is going to get shut down.
I'll agree, and I can see here actually that Hector has asked a question about if we think that this scandal is going to have a negative or a positive effect for esports, and he notes that there have been sites that allowed illegal wagers to be placed. And I think one of the core parts of this issue is that they are technically illegal wagers. There's certainly underage people who are placing these wagers, but it's all sort of centering the crux around these items. Is it of monetary value? Are you assigning a prize with value? And I will put in a huge disclaimer here. I'm not a lawyer, so take everything I say regarding legal status of these issues at purely face value and perhaps even throw it out. But there's so much debate surrounding this, and as Hayes just noted, because we're now cleaning up this issue, or at least we're attempting to clean up this issue, it opens the door for a lot of other efforts regarding setting regulations, whether it's self-regulation, government regulation, industry standards, however you want to set it up. to be set. We're seeing, you know, that the scandal has happened, and then that will allow us to hopefully learn the lesson and keep that from really tainting esports in general, any of the different games, from having something like this occur again.
Great. So moving on. So I know we touched on this a little bit, skipped one question there, but on just the being able to regulate the betting industry, and I know you guys touched upon some of the recent regulations, but does more still need to be done to ensure a safe betting experience?
I think from my perspective, there's so much that needs to be done. The betting experience is clearly in its infancy. Personally, I don't think the scandals will have any long-term impact, and they're quite minor in the scheme of things. From my perspective, we first need to really define what it is we're talking about when we say gambling on esports. To me, there's two very different forms of wagering on esports. One is sports betting. A spectator betting on the outcome of a professional sports match, or, of course, in-game bets as well. That is taking place legally in probably half a dozen or less sports books in Europe. And, of course, it's not being done legally anywhere in the United States because sports betting is illegal in the United States everywhere outside of Nevada. So there's probably a little bit of a bigger issue that than just esports betting, which, of course, the quote-unquote scandal of DFS will probably – that's probably the largest impact that will have on the gambling industry is its impact on sports betting, not to change the topic. Within the state of Nevada, there are not regulations that need to be changed since sports betting is legal, but fitting esports and defining it as a sport and getting the GCB comfortable with betting on esports is a process. But even that needs to be defined. So in Nevada, you can't just bet on football. You can't bet on a game of flag football. You can't have a high school team play football and bet on it. You can bet on the NFL, a highly regulated league. What leagues in esports are highly regulated? I think we'd all agree the LCS, the League of Legends League, is highly regulated. They have controls in place which will mitigate cheating. The likelihood of somebody throwing an LCS final is as likely as somebody throwing the NBA final. Is it possible? Sure. Highly unlikely. There are other one-off tournaments, not leagues, mostly run by ESL, which arguably is as safe. But those are not leagues. Those are one-off tournaments. For example, on October 1st in Brooklyn, ESL 1, which is a CSGO tournament. So would myself as a sportsbook operator feel comfortable taking a wager on that and the outcome of that specific tournament? Yes. But, you know, after that, betting on, you know, on online activity where there's little known about the players opens up a huge, huge can of worms, which will have to be addressed. The second type of wagering is peer-to-peer wagering. So the four of us sitting here on a webinar, if we all decided to play whatever game and bet against each other, that is certainly something that is taking place in many forms and arguably is legal in dozens of states. However, from an operator's perspective, what starts to become very questionable is taking a percentage of that wager, taking a rake. Arguably not legal, and certainly not legal in the state of Nevada. Clearly goes against NRS statutes. It is illegal. And sites that are doing that online today in the state of Nevada are technically breaking the law. So in that regard, there are regulations that need to be written and modified. And, you know, from the governor down to the chairman of the Gaming Control Board, they have absolutely created a culture and set the tone for being willing and open to changing those regulations. And certainly SB9, which has now been in place for over a year, yet nobody has put taken advantage of. No operator, no manufacturer has really put into place. It's now up to operators to take advantage of the laws to create the games, create the platforms, work with the regulators. That was a very long-winded answer to, yes, we have a lot of work to do, and by no means is it going to be a short-term play.
And I'm going to add to what Seth said, and this is something I say not just in esports, but any time I talk about, frankly, almost anything in gambling, as I cannot emphasize enough the importance of self-regulation and educating your legislators and regulators, because frequently, especially with legislators, legislators have to represent the entire population. They're not just elected and suddenly experts in gambling or suddenly experts in esports. And a lot of legislators that I've met with are actively interested in learning more about these topics. If they're going to be, I guess, sort of reigning over this thing, they want to know what they're talking about. If they're going to write laws, it has to actually assist. So if you can preemptively self-regulate and demonstrate something that works, it goes a really long way toward creating actually effective regulation. And it even can, in some cases, preempt regulation that will hinder the industry.
Absolutely. I was in Indianapolis last week at a GLI conference where we were in a room with 100 Midwest regulators. So clearly there's interest. And quite frankly, if we as an industry can show the regulators and legislators that first and foremost, the integrity of the game can be protected so we can create a fair environment, and then it happens to create jobs and increase taxes, well, I think we'll find that everyone will be open to that. But in all seriousness, my focus is very much on the land-based experience. I'm not focused online, although, you know, online is a big part of that, but also online gaming in America, you know, a much bigger topic. So my focus is on the land-based activity of esports, the ability to throw contests. My ultimate goal is to have peer-to-peer wagering on the casino floor, much like a poker room. Why does that interest me? One, it absolutely appeals to an audience that shows zero interest in slot machines. Zero, none. If there's anyone on this call who's a manufacturer, I'm sorry, your product no longer is relevant to someone under 25. I'm sure you know that. Two, while there is interest in playing blackjack, it scares the heck out of me to be an operator where my casino is full of people playing table games, which is clearly volatile and expensive. Even a poker room, very low margins because of the amount of dealers and supervision. We have found a platform that has low volatility, very low labor, incredibly low capex. I create an esports lounge for the cost of two slot machines. This is very compelling stuff. Brings in an audience that has money, that eats, drinks, and at a bare minimum creates excitement and energy in our casino. So in my opinion, there's a series of reasons why there's great value to the land-based casino experience with esports. If done properly.
Great. And I know all of that conversation stemmed from the betting question, and I know we could have more than a full hour just on that topic alone, but unfortunately we have to move on. So Seth, you touched on this a little bit in the former part of your answer. Is the global governing body necessary for esports right now?
A global governing body, global is certainly a big scope. There is a governing body, but I'll go back to what I said earlier. You know, the Gaming Control Board is okay betting on the NFL because that's a governing body for that sport. When we say global governing body in esports, the other thing we have to define is esports. That's like saying, should there be a global governing body on sports? Would that oversee golf and football and baseball and basketball and ping pong? Right? They're all so different. They're all so unique. So that's part of the challenge in esports is even in traditional sports, there's probably, what, four or five sports that are, like, predominant. The rest, quite frankly, don't matter much. In esports, there's dozens of games that are popular. So I don't know that we'll see a governing body on the entire industry as much as a governing body on specific genres and specific games and specific leagues. That being said, there are organizations I'm drawing a blank. Hi, and Brett, you may know the one that ESL is behind. That's really looking at the integrity.
What is it? WISA. Well, there's WISA, and then there's ESIG, the Esports Integrity Council.
I think that's the latest integrity. One.
Yeah,
right?
that's the latest one.
Announced a few weeks ago, and there's an interesting story there. And you know, really, the new owners of ESL, MTG out of Sweden, sponsored and funded this organization for a handful of different reasons. And what it was explained to me, I'm not sure I'm not sharing anything that's confidential, is this was as much about protecting the integrity of the game. This had nothing to do with wagering, although we'll have consequences in wagering, but more importantly, it had to do with sponsorship. So when you own this, so when a major media company bought a platform for $100 million, they want to understand what their risk was in owning this platform and why there weren't more non-endemic sponsorships within esports. And what they found was the non-endemic sponsors, the Pepsis of the world, were hesitant to sponsor a team or a tournament where there could be a cheating controversy. They'd gotten burned in tennis and even in soccer. So from that perspective, there was an integrity association that was put together to help mitigate some of those risks. And I think, you know, that will have positive consequences on the gambling industry as well.
You know,
as Seth mentioned, there's more than one game within the esports umbrella. It's also, I think it's so important to differentiate between esports and betting on esports, because the esports industry itself is its own industry. It's a sport competition industry, and then there's betting, which in many ways is peripheral, but also in many ways firmly integrated into the sport. So any type of organization would really have to acknowledge the difference between the two. And as Seth mentioned, the creation, for example, of the ESIC was very much about integrity of the game, while wagering, you know, maybe part of the integrity, but it's not the core of this coalition. And so while it's some sort of governing body, whatever it might be, would almost certainly have to have a component of it related to gambling, its primary interest wouldn't necessarily be gambling. That might be a separate entity, sort of like we have the AGA, in which gambling companies come together and discuss regulatory and industry issues. We may also have something like that for esports, or perhaps even integrate esports into some other existing gambling organization.
All right. And if you look back, you know, in terms of it, while it may look like esports is unregulated and there's no governing body, there are several around. I mean, the IESF, which is the International Esports Federation, has been around since, I believe, 2008, give or take, and it is global, and it is sort of playing a role like the IOC, and in fact, it is pitching to the IOC now to, you know, make esports an Olympic sport. Which is interesting. Big news came out today that Alibaba is now going to support them financially in China, and that's going to give them the money to do this. But like what Brett has said, you know, a lot of these governing bodies aren't focused on gaming, and there are some that are actually counter gaming. I guess a close analogy would be like the NFL saying, you know, we don't want people betting on football. There are federations that stand up for that. But most the big thing is that it does have an ancillary effect, because a lot of these federations do try to protect the integrity. They do look at, like IESF has just been accepted as a signatory to WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. What? Sorry? Yeah, nobody uses drugs in esports. But you know, it's crazy. So if you look at sports in general, even if you have a governing body, it doesn't make much, you know, sometimes it doesn't make much of a difference. Just look at the Brazil game, right? With Russia now being banned out of, you know, most of their, you know, and, you know, we've had Olympic games, you know, the modern Olympic games anyway, for over 30 events. And we still have these issues, even with multiple international bodies.
What Brett mentioned is, you know, there's definitely a difference between the regulations of the game for the game's sake versus regulations for gambling and the protection of the spectator or the gambler. But once again, using the LCS, the League of Legends League, as an example, there can't be any more of a highly regulated, highly organized league, of which scandals have, the outcome has been teams being banned and ruining mm-hmm. people's careers. The Downtown Grand sponsored a CSGO team, the LA Renegades, who had a sister team, the LA Renegades, in the LCS that was booted from the LCS. It was a huge scandal. And for anybody on the webinar not familiar, many of the significant brands within esports have multiple teams that play multiple games.
Right, and the only thing I would add to that, just in closing, is also, like, LCS is a great example. It is also, a lot of these organizations are also run by the same people who develop the software. Because right now there are a lot of esports games out there, and a lot of these leagues are run, like the CS:GO League is run by Valve, and the LCS with Riot, you can see that as problems, but you can also see that as not, because they have an intimate knowledge of the code base and what the game can do, and in a sense, they're the best people to regulate it.
And it's proprietary software, which is also an important point when we talk about regulation of the game.
Right. So if you think of it in the real world sense, or in our existing reality with physical sports, it's sort of like the inventor of football actually regulating football, and they get to change the rules if they want to, and actually a lot of esports games do have evolving rules and evolving systems, because they update their games. They add characters, they change weighting structures, they change weapon effectiveness. A lot of things change, and that all plays, has an effect as well.
Great. Before we move on to our next question, we have a question from the audience that's directed to Seth. Just asking, can you speak to the legality of the esports tournaments that are being held at your casino property? And
sure.
Then give some examples, sports wagering, skill-based wagering.
Yeah, that's a great question. So today we have not taken our first sports wager on a professional match yet. We were actually looking to do that on a major fighting game tournament, which was a live tournament in Las Vegas this month called EVO. But quite frankly, that got very complicated, which I think addresses some of the issues we've just spoken about for the past 5 minutes. This was a specific tournament on fighting games, I believe, 6 to 9 different games. They almost have to think of it as like 9 different tournaments within a weekend, of which anybody could, in theory, pay a fee to participate. So early on, if you think about like an NC2A bracket, the earlier games could easily be thrown. Two people could play against each other. Outsiders could wager on them. There's very little to risk. The likelihood of somebody throwing the final match, obviously far more greater. But that became a very complicated first tournament to focus on. From a regulated perspective, there's no league to get kicked out of. The referees are all voluntary, so needless to say, especially coming out of the gate, that turned out not to be the best approach, and instead we're focused on a professional tournament that's taking place in Europe in December. In terms of the activities that take place on a weekly basis in the Downtown Grand, and currently we operate a contest on Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, those are contests. So specifically, they are not peer-to-peer wagering. They are the contest model, which falls under a specific regulation where participants pay a fixed entry. Today it's $15, gets you an entry for a fixed prize, generally in between $250 to $1,000. The prize does not fluctuate based on the number of entries. So therefore the Downtown Grand isn't taking a percentage or a rake, but is taking anything above and beyond the contest a prize. We are cash flow positive in terms of those events. I'd say it's a break even, but we're not losing money based on the entry fees and based on ancillary revenue such as food and beverage and and some traditional gambling activities. We do see the gamers playing blackjack, roulette, and a little bit of craps. Further, because we've held these weekly contests, we've really planted the flag and positioned the Downtown Grand as certainly an esports-friendly hotel, which has therefore led to much larger activations, such as major pool parties. So during Evo, we had 1,600 people come to a pool party, which is a major pool party for us. I mean, to give you an idea, on a Friday night, we normally get 400 people. So, you know, four times our average, which obviously led to a ton of food and beverage sales, and, of course, people staying in our hotel as well. So it's been a holistic strategy to create and reposition our brand to really be significant with the esports audience. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it definitely does. So moving on a little bit, and Seth, this is again directed to you, and we have had a few more questions from the audience that are directed in this nature. And you've touched on this, but what types of opportunities does esports offer to the gaming industry, both domestically and abroad? And that's both physical land-based casinos and on the internet.
Yeah, so look, let me focus on land-based, and let me just, you know, focus domestically and initially only because that's my experience recently. That being said, you know, obviously I have a lot of experience in Macau, and I do think that there's a huge opportunity there based on the popularity of esports in China, which is the fastest growing market in the world. But let me first clearly state, it is not a one-size-fits-all strategy. So, for example, let me really get local and just focus here on in Nevada for a moment. The strategy at the Downtown Grand works with the Downtown Grand because the Downtown Grand already catered to and was successfully catering to the millennial audience. The design very much is relevant to the millennial audience. The type of casino, in the sense that it's a boutique urban casino, which is walking distance to all sorts of cool and affordable downtown bars and restaurants, is relevant to the esports audience. It's priced well to the esports audience. So let's you know, be realistic. We're talking about a younger demographic whose wallet has a certain budget, so they can afford our room, they can afford our food and beverage. There are other hotel resorts, casino resorts in Las Vegas that I think will have a much harder time implementing this strategy because the player is not going to be able to afford a $300 room on a Friday or even eat in some of the restaurants. So I would first, you know, ask an operator to really, you know, be honest and feel, will their property work with this audience? And there's different strategies. So we're activating an esports lounge. We actually converted our high-limit room to an esports lounge. Now, to be completely transparent, if our high-limit room was generating millions of dollars in revenue, we probably wouldn't have done that. So once again, it was a good solution and a good fit for our property. Because we did put it in our high-limit room, which was directly off the casino floor, we've also found that the esports player they've really felt like we've treated them respectfully. So the experience is far exceeds their expectations. People are always shocked when they come to our casino and they expect the esports lounge to be in some, you know, unused corner of the property, off the casino floor, and the fact that it's in the premier property, premier location, goes a long way.
I think Seth mentioned something that's very important, and I just want to highlight that to anybody, any other operators out there looking at this. The community works a lot from a social basis and credibility. And what Seth has done at the Downtown Grand is really solidified the Downtown Grand's creds in the esports world or in the gaming world, that people have recognized that it's not just a property trying to capitalize on this phenomenon to make money, because the commitments that they've done in and the space that they've put in, where they've put the space, and the events that they're organizing have all lent to creating an atmosphere that gamers feel is one of theirs, that they can trust, that they would like to be in, and is not just a poser. That's actually quite a, because of the social environment around gaming, I'm talking about esports and video gaming, it does carry a lot of weight. And that's the one thing that a lot of properties that try to do this, this is probably one of the mistakes that they'll make. They're thinking like, oh, you know, if we build it, they will come. And it won't necessarily happen, because you need to have you need to convince the community that this is not just trying to profit off of them, but this is actually an esports and a video game and a game-friendly environment that they can come hang out with their friends and do things that they like to do.
And I've also heard that there's not necessarily reluctance, but trepidation perhaps from major parts of the gambling industry. And I actually have a report that I see they're coming out this week or next week with Chris Grove from Legal Sports Report, in which we look at industry attitudes toward esport, both for integration into land-based casinos as well as opportunities online, hosting events, all of these types of things. And one of the most important things that we found was people who have been exposed to esports, who have experience with esports, they've attended an event or they've hosted an event, something like that, they're more likely to see opportunity in esports itself. And then beyond that, there's still some caution. Even if you think that there's a substantial amount of opportunity, there's caution in taking advantage of that opportunity. And I think that's something that we as a gambling industry need to overcome.
Right. And I think one of the things that everybody needs to understand about this, the virtual world of gaming, video gaming, and competitive gaming especially, is that it's a community that you really can't lie about. If I go out there and I say I play CSGO or I play I play League of Legends or I play Dota, all they need to ask is what's my handle, and they can look up all my stats. I can't lie about being a good player. It's all there. So you're talking to a community that is very, very transparent. When you compare that with any other business or any other, structure, even academia, it's fuzzy at some point. Mm-hmm. And so this is really a community that is built on transparency. And that's why sometimes if you monitor, the Reddit blogs and stuff like that, you will see people getting grilled, who are basically coming in and say, oh, now I'm an esports expert. And they totally get trashed online because their creds can be verified to be, they just played their first game for a week. And now they're saying they've been playing it for years. So, you can't lie about stuff like that.
So from a casino perspective,
I'm Kriparian.
from a casino perspective, I don't think that anything that's being said is completely unique to esports and should scare anybody who's listening. So if anybody on the line runs a local casino, we're all too familiar with senior days and bingo rooms that are unprofitable to create loyalty and to create an environment where a certain segment or demographic finds our casinos comfortable. They want to come. Sometimes they spend more money than other times. This is not a novel concept to create an environment that is attractive to a specific demographic. And we're not, ultimately over time, of course, we're looking for profitability. Over time, we're all running businesses. But, to this audience, you gotta build it. You gotta build the credibility. You gotta build that base first. And as I mentioned earlier, it is not a very expensive proposition. It is far more expensive for us to go spend $25,000 to $100,000 on a mediocre band and hope that we make it up in ticket sales and food and beverage. And if there's any operators on the phone, we all know we've screwed up on that one. And that's a far more costly proposition than, having video game tournaments. So that's, I think from, I went into this with an open mind and realizing that I didn't know anything about esports. The highest point, I was the farthest thing from an expert. Playing Mortal Kombat with my 7-year-old son is about the most relevant thing that I did in my life before getting into esports. But over time, I found that I am able to leverage the things I've learned as an operator. I am able to draw from my experience and take what's worked in the past and try to apply it to this audience. The 23-year-old esports millennial, it has different behaviors. Yes, we have, lives online far more than I'm sure most of us on this phone. But there are still plenty of tricks of the trade that apply to this audience.
And
they were not put here on Mars.
Yeah. I got disconnected, and I see we're almost done here. So I'll just ask the last question for him, I guess. Which
no,
the
I'm on. I just lost
industry.
The ability to.
Betting. Where do we think that this is going in the next 5 to 10 years? Do one of you guys want to start and just ask myself my own question?
esports betting, Brett? I'm sorry. Where do we think esports betting is going?
Where is it going to go in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so I don't want to rehash everything I said a few minutes ago, but I think that's really, I think it's going to be very telling where sports betting goes in America in the next 5 years. That's the bigger question. Before that's resolved, esports betting isn't going to go anywhere legally in the United States. It's illegal to bet on sports. I mean, it's stating the obvious, but it probably has to be stated nonetheless. And from a peer-to-peer perspective, I believe that we're going to see, whether it's in casinos or in land centers throughout the country, more opportunities for people to bet against each other on esports, and we're just in
tournaments and contests.
For sure.
Yeah, I think there's a lot.
Sorry, hi.
Yeah, I think there's a lot's going to happen in the next few years, and Seth is totally right when you're talking about sports betting. You know, we have a bigger problem. We have PASPA and we have all that working against it. So that has to be resolved first before anything would happen. But it doesn't mean that you can't make use of esports as a way to either convert customers or explore a new angle of monetizing that demographic. And, what I would like to bring up as well is that it's not just an age demographic in the sense that you're looking at right now. The term, sometimes, we definitely associate the term millennials with an age demographic. But in a sense, it's actually more, it's almost like a state of mind, right? There are a lot of Gen Xers. There are even some baby boomers that identify millennial because of the technology that they've decided to use and the technology that they've become comfortable of using. Just look at Pokemon Go and the kind of people who are the age group that plays Pokemon Go. I mean, there are 60-year-old grandfathers that are playing it. Yes, there are the 12-year-olds, but there's that. And I think a good indication of basically a successful integration with esports, with conversion and with other business. I mean, just look at the Downtown Grand. They're an example. They took, Seth took the risk, did the right things and made it happen. And, that the evil party is indication of that growth. It was a big increase from the last party that was thrown there after the LCS, at Mandalay Bay. And you would, both of these events happened on the strip, but the big party happened downtown.
The clothing line. I'll also add, just from a more general perspective on esports, the adaptation to technology and growing up with technology is more and more normalized with every year of new children, every birth year. And so kids are growing up with this activity. It's so much easier to access now just with the internet. You can have computer-based games. You don't necessarily need a console, but there are a variety of consoles at so many different price points. That video games are a huge part, even from a learning perspective. We do a ton of educational tools with games and video games. And this is something that's just going to continue getting more and more common, which means that these types of games are going to be more and more familiar to people growing up, and it's sort of like this growth of interest in something that will continue to be part of both sport and gambling.
And you know, final thing to note as well is, we're gonna close it off. All right.
No, go ahead. You get 60 seconds.
You know, esports, you have to remember, esports, like Seth said earlier, is not just one game. There are a lot of games, and games are increasing, and they're being added all the time. You know, we had Overwatch that came in a couple of months ago. Today, there's another announcement of a new game coming from Crytek. There are a lot of games, and each game will create a league, may or may not. It may join an ESL league. It may or may not. And there's going to be a lot more coming to the future. I mean, if you just look at the Super Data stats, they said, you know, 1 billion 2019. Last week, they said 1 billion 2017. So the growth is incredible. And it's a moving goalpost. You know, you really need somebody who knows what they're doing, who plays games, who at least monitors the stuff. And, you know, because the board is changing on a daily basis.
Thanks, everybody.
Great. Yeah, we have a few requests for our attendees before we sign off. But first, we want to thank Brett, Seth, and Hi again for taking the time to impart some of their knowledge on esports with us. Sorry, I'm unfortunately unable to share my screen anymore. But so our first request for attendees is just to let everyone know that esports will be on both the educational program lineup and interactively demonstrated on the floor this year at G2E. And all of you can learn more or register at globalgamingexpo.com. And then the final request is that you should all be receiving an email shortly with a survey on the webinar. Completing this survey will allow us to continue to improve the webinar experience for you all moving forward. Thanks again to everyone for joining, and we hope it was an informative and insightful hour.